He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. Thank you for taking time to join us as we take time to learn from God's Word together. The message you are about to hear comes from Pastor John Twitchell at the Cape Elizabeth Church of the Nazarene in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Listen to more sermons or learn more about the church at our website, capenazarene.org.
I didn't know my parents were going to be here today. So this little story was not in my sermon notes, but I'll tell it now. I learned how to use a computer when I was very, very young. 4 years old, maybe. I think probably was when the first computer came into the house. Yeah, that sounds about right. I can remember as a young child being given an allowance, and I had a little cedar box upstairs that I kept my money in. And I remember being taught as a young child to take that allowance and to divide up a portion for savings and a portion for me and a portion to give to God. And I remember clearly, plain as day, goodness, I must have been third grade, learning how to use a spreadsheet so that I could keep track of my income and set up formulas and determine and balance my little cash box upstairs. And of course, factor in a tithe to give to God. I remember getting $4 a week allowances. And either that's a testament to my age or my dad's stinginess. I'm not sure which. Those are habits that have gone far through life. For at the end of each month, I sit down to carefully calculate my tithe check to give to God. Go through my records, I add up income from my paycheck, miscellaneous income from the funeral home, income from Melody's piano lessons, and any other miscellaneous income that's come in. Take the total, divide it by 10, because I don't like to be legalistic in my tithing. I round it up to the next nearest $5. That was a joke. Okay. And add on my faith promise for missions, which goes to support missionary work around the world, and write a check to the church, which I put in the offering plate on the first Sunday of each month. Many of you do a very similar routine in your own lives. Now, also at the same time, there may be some today who are surprised and say, I didn't know the pastor put money in the offering plate too. After all, he's a pastor. He doesn't need to give anything. And I have a friend. Some of you remember my friend Jeff and Dorothy. His dad was a pastor. And he always tells the story of when he was a kid growing up, his friends at school would say to him, "Is it true that your dad gets to keep everything that comes in the offering plate?" So there's lots of misconceptions about tithing and offerings. Some of you know how much I get paid. Some of you know how much Melody charges for piano lessons. And you might be surprised to learn that we live on 90% of our income. The fact is, a lot of people in today's culture look at the concept of tithing as outdated or legalistic, and some people wonder why in the world Christians would willingly part with 10% of their hard-earned money each week, choosing to live on the remaining 90%. Well, this morning I want to talk to you about some of the reasons why I give, in hopes that you might find some increased meaning in your giving, that it might not simply be putting money in the offering plate, but you might think about the reasons why you give as well, and you might find increased meaning in your gifts to God. So here are just a few of the reasons I give. I give because it makes me feel good, right? Makes you happy to give. This month's Reader's Digest actually included an article entitled "Why We're Happy," and gave five what they called happiness predictors. And the fourth one on that list was charity. The article goes on to state, people who give money to charity are 43% more likely than non-givers to say that they're happy. In essence, the more people give, the happier they get. End quote. I'm sure scientists could figure out why it is that giving makes us happy. Maybe it releases endorphins into the brain and gives us one of those natural highs. I don't know. I suspect instead it has something to do with the fact that we were created in the image of God. God who is full of grace and generosity. In other words, we are more fully human whenever we give, reflecting the nature of the God who created us. Well, secondly, I give because the church is a cause I believe in. During the 11 years that Melody and I have been married, we've consistently given to organizations that we believe in. the camp I served at when I was in high school and college, the local Christian radio station in Freeport, an agency that helps us sponsor a child in Tanzania. Most of us here in this room give to organizations we believe in. When the random phone call from the organization we don't believe in calls up, we're likely to hang up on them, politely, of course, but we don't give money to organizations we don't believe in. And since we believe in the mission of this local church, we make sure that the vast majority of our giving goes right here to support this ministry. In addition to that, we give to Faith Promise. Why? Because we believe in the cause of Nazarene missions taking the gospel of Jesus Christ around the world. The third reason I give is because giving offers me a chance to count my blessings. Ever thought about that? Each month when I sit down and calculate that tithe check, I'm reminded of how much God has provided for me that month, how much God has provided for us. It's an opportunity for me to thank God for his provisions in our lives. And on the months when I get to write that bigger tithe check, that's good news, because I'm reminded that we were more blessed. See, giving to God becomes an opportunity then for us to review God's faithfulness to us and to express our gratitude to him. It's this attitude of gratitude that allows us to give with a cheerful heart, as written about in 2 Corinthians. There are lots of other reasons that people give, I'm sure, out of habit. Some people might give so people see them giving. Some people give for the tax write-off. Some might give out of guilt. Some might give because they see that the need is great. But I want to spend the rest of our time this morning looking at the primary biblical principle that should be underneath all of the reasons we might give. And that principle is summed up today in the concept of first fruits. First fruits. During the Israelites' time in the wilderness, God established a number of covenant rules with them. And one of those was this covenant festival of first fruits. And the basic understanding of first fruits was that the Israelite children would take the very first and the very best of their harvest and give it to God. This was a way of giving thanks for the harvest. But more than that, it was a way for them to acknowledge that God was the source of that harvest, that God was the provider, that God was the owner of everything they had, and that God would faithfully take care of his children. I was reminded of the concept of first fruits when I went into IGA earlier this week and actually found some first fruits right there on the shelf. For right there at the front of the store is the very first of the strawberry harvest from down here at Jordan's. They open tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock for public picking, but before they do that, they send workers through the field to pick the first fruits, the very first part of the harvest that will probably be spoiled by the time they open it to the public. And they can take it and box it up and take it to local stores and farm stands. Here's the thing. The strawberry crop could still be ruined. Heavy rain, hailstorms, aggressive crows, we have them, insects, diseases, all of those could still, even between tonight and tomorrow morning, do a significant amount of damage to the strawberry crop. But if they do, it wouldn't be a total loss because they've already taken their first fruits and sold them down here at IGA and other farm stands. See, what the Israelites were asked to do with those first fruits, though, was not to eat them, not to sell them, but to give those first fruits to God, an act of faith that they would rely on him to take care of them, even if the rest of the crop failed. So from a human perspective, this concept of first fruits is a great risk. Great risk, but from a divine perspective, an opportunity to see God at work. The principle of first fruits reminds us that we are to rely on God, not on our own abilities or riches. The principle of first fruits also reminds us that everything really belongs to God in the first place. Sometimes we make this mistake of thinking that we're being generous when we give to God. I've done that. But that's a mistake when I think I'm being generous to God, for the reality is, he is only trusting us to take care of his resources in the first place. One of our leading lay people in the denomination, Dr. Dave McClung, who was interim president at ENC not too long ago, he recently said this, quote, Somehow, many people have become confused about the meaning of stewardship. They equate stewardship with how much one gives to the church or with tithing. They view part of their assets as theirs and part as God's. That isn't a proper understanding of stewardship. The concept of stewardship relates to who is the ultimate owner of an asset. In biblical times, there were no banks, no investment houses, or stock exchanges. When a person gained more wealth than they could personally manage, it was common for that person to seek out another person who would manage part of their assets. That asset manager was a steward. Dr. McClung continues. The rules of the arrangement were this, that the steward got full use of the assets, including use of some of it for the steward's own lifestyle. But the owner of the asset retained all ownership rights, including, number one, the owner could require a full accounting for the assets at any time without notice. Two, he could demand that possession of the assets be returned at any time without notice. And three, he could place any restriction he wanted on the use of the assets. It was customary that a steward that produced a positive cash flow back to the owner would be allowed wide latitude concerning the management of the assets. Dr. McClung then went on to quote a portion of our manual statement, which reads this: The scriptures teach that God is the owner of all persons and all things. We, therefore, are his stewards of both life and possessions. God's ownership and our stewardship ought to be acknowledged, for we shall be held personally accountable to God for the exercise of our stewardship. End quote. And the end of my quote from Dr. McClung. That was the cultural background in the Bible for what a steward was, someone who would manage assets for someone else. And we're reminded that we are God's stewards, managing God's assets. The fact is, it's far too easy to forget that God owns everything we have. Isn't it? Yeah. And then, even when we remember that God does own everything, we have another mistaken assumption we make. Here's the assumption. We think that God loaned it to us for our personal use. And if we take that mindset, then we see tithing as some sort of a royalty, or we're paying God interest on the stuff he's letting us use. God has not loaned us his stuff for our personal use. He has entrusted us with his stuff so we might manage it for his use. You see the difference there? The principle of first fruits reminds us that everything we have is God's and that it is primarily to be used for his purposes. Well, let's take a look at a couple of ways this principle was played out in Scripture. The Israelites were reminded of the principle of first fruits in a very practical way when they first moved into the Promised Land. You remember Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho. And the walls came a-tumbling down. What you may not remember, because it's not one of those things that we remember to teach in Sunday school, what you may not remember is that God basically identified Jericho as the first fruits of the Promised Land. In Joshua 6:26, God told Joshua to tell the people, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son will he lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest will he set up its gates." Now get this. The Israelite children had just moved into the Promised Land. They are strangers. They are aliens in a foreign land. They have no land. They have no cities. They have no defenses. They live in tents, wandering in the wilderness for the past several years. Here's what logic would dictate. That upon defeating the people of Jericho, a nice walled city, they would take it over. Fix the walls back up a bit and use it as their home base. Nice defenses, nice place to live. But God wanted them to remember who owned the land. And God wanted them to remember who it was that was going to win their battles. Well, the city of Jericho did, in fact, lie in ruins for many years. But King Ahab, wicked King Ahab, some of us like to call him, authorized Hiel to rebuild Jericho. And 1 Kings 16, verse 34 tells us that, quote, "He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub." King Ahab and Hiel, they forgot the very first principle of first fruits, that the land was not theirs to do with as they pleased, but the land belonged to God. Well, if you keep reading in 1 Kings, you come to 1 Kings 17. It's the next piece over here. It tells us a story about a prophet of God named Elijah who was fed by the faithfulness of a widow. A widow who not only gave her first fruits, but who gave her last fruits as well. You remember the story. At the beginning of 1 Kings 17, Elijah prophesies that there'll be a great famine in the land, perhaps because of the rebuilding of Jericho we just read about, but mostly because of the evil deeds of wicked King Ahab. God tells Elijah to go live by a brook where ravens bring him bread and meat, but then because of the famine, the brook dries up, and God tells him to go find this widow. Elijah finds her and asks for some bread, and the widow tells him that she has only a little flour and oil, and that she is going home to make one last loaf of bread for her and her son before they die of starvation. Elijah said to her in verse 13, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son." Was Elijah listening? Didn't she just say she has only enough bread and oil to make one loaf of bread? Elijah says, "Go make me some bread and then make some for you and your son." Elijah goes on, verse 14, "For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, 'The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land.'" She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. You see, when it comes to stewardship, you and I have to remember that God retains the right to make a cash call on everything we own. Stewardship isn't just about tipping God by dropping in a 20 on Sunday morning. It's about recognizing that everything we have belongs to him, and that he has a right to claim it at any time. Oh, he can claim 10% of it, he can claim 100% of it. Sometimes he asks us to give out of our abundance. Sometimes, like this widow, he asks us to give out of our poverty. And we tithe primarily in order to remind ourselves of this, that it all belongs to God. You see, but long before the story of Elijah and the widow, long before the Battle of Jericho, long before God made his covenant with the Israelites in the wilderness, we find another story that reminds us that God owns everything. Our land, our wealth, even our lives. You may have wondered, haven't we been in Genesis? What's he doing in 1 Kings today? Well, we're going to go in a moment and read our lesson from Genesis chapter 22. You'll remember that Abraham had long awaited the promise of a child to carry on his line. Anywhere between 15 to 25 years he had waited, so that he could, in fact, be the father of a great nation. The last several weeks, we looked at some of those obstacles in the way of Abraham and Sarah, the methods that he and Sarah had used to try to make the promise come true by their own doing. And you remember that the promise finally did come true, and Isaac was born. I invite you now to hear the word of the Lord as recorded in Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about." Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father?"
"Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?"
Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham."
"Here I am," he replied.
"Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The word of the Lord for his children today. Talk about the principle of first fruits. Abraham had waited for this son. He had believed God's promise. He had packed up his belongings, gone to an unknown country, and he had finally seen the promise come true. And then God makes the ultimate cash call. God says, "Give the boy to me." God doesn't just ask for 10%, he asks for the whole nine yards. He doesn't just ask for fruit from the vine. This time he's asking for fruit from Abraham's own body. He doesn't just ask for Abraham and Sarah's first descendant. He asks for their only son. You and I can't possibly imagine what Abraham thought or went through that day. Did he try to negotiate with God? Did he try to sneak off in the other direction? It doesn't appear that he did either of those things. In fact, the only questions that are recorded here are the ones asked by Isaac as they made their way up the mountain. And when Isaac began to ask those questions, Abraham responded with a simple faith, "God will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And that is precisely what God did. That's why we give. That's why we give. We give to God because God is faithful and his promises are forever. We give to God because it forces us to abandon our security blankets, our pacifiers, and instead trust in God wholeheartedly. Faithful stewardship of God's resources reminds us that it's not about our jobs. It's not about the size of our bank accounts. It's about God's faithfulness to provide for his children. Putting God first in our finances reminds us it's not about trusting in our credit cards to get us through the hard times or hoping that our cushion is big enough for retirement. We give because it reminds us that we worship the God we sang about earlier, Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides.
Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Jesus Christ throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you for listening to this week's sermon. More sermons are available online at our website, capenazarene.org. Our website also includes instructions for subscribing to our podcast so you can have a message delivered to you weekly. May God bless you as you serve him this week.